Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill, and Mr. Taylor, whose writings in the industry you can regularly read over on The Wrap, and whose musings on the Mission Impossible movies you can listen to on Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. He and I are recording this week's show on Sunday, January 7th. And the Golden Globes are tonight, right?
They are tonight for those that care. I am not in that camp, so
all right.
Well, look.
All right. I think as far as back as Pia Zadora and Butterfly, there's always been a question about the Golden Globes. What was it? Starting in the 90s and sort of leading into the 2000s, they became sort of the pregame show for the Oscars, kind of, sort of, right?
Sort of, Jim, but they are also so wildly off base. I mean, part of this is the long-standing history with corruption and being bought by studios and stars. But, you know, they gave Madonna the Oscar for Evita, Jim. I mean, this is not exactly the bellwether test some think that it is for the Oscars. Yeah.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, everybody was willing to turn a blind eye to this sort of stuff till what, 2021, when that report came out that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the voting body for the Golden Globes, didn't have a single black member, things kind of collapsed after that, right? The studios and stars boycotted the 2022. And then I want to say in 2023, NBC broke off its 30-year relationship with the Globes. And so this time around, CBS is broadcasting them, and they're being streamed internationally by Paramount Plus. You know, that said, it is worth noting that there are still those who sort of look to the Globes as sort of a hint as to where the award season is going to go. And so in that spirit, it's worth noting that the Best Motion Picture Animated, the nominees for the Globes tonight are Hayao Miyazaki's A Boy and the Heron, Pixar's Elemental, Sony Picture Animation's Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, Toho's Suzume, Illumination's Super Mario Brothers movie, and finally Walt Disney Animation Studios' Wish. Toward what Drew was just saying, is this is a new category for this year, right? The Cinematic and Box Office Achievement Award.
Yes.
You know, who brought in the biggest pile of coin, I guess? And worth noting here that there are two animated features included in the pile here. Sony Pictures Animation, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, and the Super Mario Brothers movie, again from Illuminations, along with Barbie, Oppenheimer, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, John Wick 4, and a film you might know a little bit about, Drew, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, but also the Taylor Swift concert film, the Eras Tour. So, again, going to be interesting to see the reaction there. Rounding things out, original score, two animated features were recognized for their motion picture work. Again, The Boy and the Heron and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. And then, I gotta love this one, Best Original Song Motion Picture from the Super Mario Brothers movie, Peaches. And is the deal that Jack Black just ad-libbed that, right?
I don't know. What is that, the story? I'm not that well-versed in Peaches, Jim, so you'll have to tell me.
Okay, no, that's what I'd heard. So anyway, how might all of this potentially impact this year's Oscars? Well, it is worth noting that voting for this year's Academy Award nominations begins later this week, Thursday, January 11th, and then closes next week on Tuesday, January 16th. And then we get our official Oscar nominations announced 1 week after that on Tuesday, January 23rd. And this year, worth noting that the 96th Academy Awards are going to be held on March 10th. And in between that, the Annies are going to be held at UCLA's Royce Hall on February 17th. And to be honest, that's really more of the bellwether, right? About, you know, which way things might go for animation?
Well,
the Annies?
I mean, the Annies has not been without its controversy, Jim, as we know, about how Jeffrey Katzenberg made all of the members of DreamWorks Animation sign up to be able to vote to somewhat sway the vote. I think that things have kind of leveled out over there, but
I was about to say, that was a while ago, and Jeffrey at this point is, what, off busy raising money for Biden, right?
He's raising money for Biden, but he's also interestingly kind of trying to sway smaller elections all across the country, which is really interesting. But he is pretty much a full-time kind of political operative these days. I've always wanted to go to the Annies, even though I hear it's like 9,000 hours long and very tedious. But I would like to sit there and hang out and shoot the breeze with people.
Let's see if we can make that happen this
year.
But just a quick note, that's really interesting that that's how Katzenberg is choosing to spend his twilight years. Because remember, he started out as the boy wonder with John Lindsay, didn't he?
Yes.
I mean, yeah. Wow. That's interesting that he returned to that.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, kind of a light news week, folks. As always, want to let you know about who's sponsoring the news portion of today's Fine Tuning. And this time around, it's being brought to you by Touring and Cruises, formerly known as Touring Plans Travel. That may be a different name, but it's the same team. And this dedicated group of travel advisors is ready to transform your dreams into unforgettable memories. So please check them out at touringandcruises.com. All right. On previous show, Drew has talked about how much he enjoyed Leo, Adam Sandler's new animated feature. That, of course, came from the folks at Animal Logic, that Australian animation and visual effects studio, which Netflix acquired like 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, they did the Magician's Elephant or whatever that
there
movie
we go.
Was.
There
right?
we go.
Yeah, and then Leo.
They are now, after this acquisition, formally being integrated into Netflix global animation studio structure. And as a result of the streamlining of operations, Sharon Taylor, formerly the CEO of Animal Logic, has resigned, and Karen Tolliver, who's the VP and leader of Netflix Animated Film Division, she's going to take over day-to-day operations at Animal Logic. And next up from these talented folks is Ron Howard's animated feature directorial debut, The Shrinking of Treehorn, I want to say, which is based on a book by Florence Parry Hyde.
Whatever you say, Jim. That sounds like a Mad Lib that you concocted, but I'm sure it's true.
I'm actually excited to see what Ron Howard could do as an animated feature. You know, I've enjoyed a lot of that guy's work. Now, did you get to see the trailer that dropped back on Thanksgiving for Justice League Crisis on Infinite Earth Part 1?
I did. I thought it looked really cool.
Yeah, same thing here. This is the first installment of a new animated trilogy coming from, what is it, the DC films at Warner Brothers, which, by the way, is based on Marv Wolfman and George Lopez's famous DC comic series from 85 and 86. It actually debuts digitally today, the day that this podcast goes live, January 9th. Then 2 weeks from today, on Tuesday, January 23rd, the 4K ultra-high-def version will become available as a limited edition steelbook, as well as the standard Blu-ray. And while we're talking up superhero-related stuff, worth noting that now all 9 episodes of Season 2 of Marvel's What If, they did that 9-day-long programming event over on Disney Plus, with the last episode dropping December 30th. So those are all available to view. And it's worth noting that in the mid-credits in episode 9 of season 2, we get a tease for season 3 of Marvel What If. We see the Winter Soldier and the Red Guardian looking to elude Nick Fury in a car chase. By the way, not exactly a surprise that we were going to get a season 3 of Marvel's What If. That actually got announced back in July of 2022 at San Diego Comic-Con. And while we're noting the, you know, return of Marvel-related stuff, season two of Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur is going to debut beginning of next month, Friday, February 2nd. What's kind of interesting is these episodes will initially premiere on Disney Channel and Disney XD and become available for streaming the next day on Disney Plus. And finally, let's just take a look at the box office for this past weekend, January 5th through the 7th, and Migration came in fourth at the domestic box office behind Wonka, Night Swim, and Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. This Illumination film sold 10.25 million in domestic tickets, and that brings its box office in North America up to 77 million, 72 million overseas, with a worldwide box office so far of 150. Now, Disney's Wish, on the other hand, just 62 million domestic. And by the way, a number of folks at Illuminations reached out to point that out to me, you know, just like, yeah, you know, we're doing better than that. On the other hand, overseas, Disney's latest has done 119 million. So worldwide box office of 181 million, which, as Drew pointed out last week, when it costs $200 million to make your movie, that's not a great place to be. On the other hand, I don't know if we brought this up last week, Illumination's Migration supposedly only cost $72 million to make. So that has a better chance of recovering its production costs at this point. Anyway, when we get back, Drew and I are going to take a look at a time when Disney used to make a lot of money off of its older animation titles. But first, this. And we're back. Drew, as we were pre-gaming tonight, you wanted to talk a little bit about a kerfuffle that happened in regard to some animation news last week, particularly BOOO, right?
Yes, the Bureau of Otherworldly, what was the, what does the acronym stand for, Jim? Bureau of Otherworldly Operations or something?
I believe so. And all right, correct me if I'm wrong. This was a film that DreamWorks Animation had in the works. In fact, wasn't Melissa McCarthy supposed to be one of the voices in this thing, or?
Yeah, well, it went through a few iterations. Remember when it was Boo You? It was actually
Okay, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was sort of set at a college. Mm-hmm. It is a super classified agency you've never heard of and certainly have never seen. Dedicated to protecting humans from evil hauntings, the agents of Boo have a secret weapon. They are ghosts themselves. So it starred Seth Rogen as a new ghost. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's partnered with Melissa McCarthy. The rest of the cast included Bill Murray, Matt Bomer, Octavia Spencer, Jennifer Coolidge, and where we're getting into trouble here is Rashida Jones. Now, what happened was there was a Variety article about the most anticipated performances of 2024, which is super weird to begin mm-hmm. with. But then okay. in the write-up for Rashida Jones, they talked about how Boo was supposed to come out this year. And people went absolutely insane because they had been, you know, I don't know when this thing, when was this in development, Jim? Like, you know,
forever. I want to say, wasn't this one of the films that got killed when DreamWorks was sold to Universal? I mean, yes. There were a number of projects that, you know, just for house cleaning. I mean, wasn't Monkeys of Mumbai in that same pile? And
yes, which is interesting because I've been hearing that there's another Bollywood type movie in development right now.
Hmm. Okay.
That is not Monkeys of Mumbai, so I don't want anyone to get that twisted.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, it looks like it was supposed to be released in 2015, but in October 2014, they pulled it from the release schedule. So, yeah, DreamWorks, I mean, this is dead. I have to say that unequivocally. And this thing popped up in Variety, and people went absolutely insane thinking that it was back, and it was actually just poor reporting. The guy that wrote it is not the best reporter, and that showed. Very nice guy, but he was using, I think, outdated information, and it was a bad situation. So I wanted to just clear that up, Jim, that it is not happening. Mm-hmm. Somebody said, well, it's 60% animated, which it's not 60% animated. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted to finish it, they would have to redo the entire movie because every two movies at DreamWorks, the entire pipeline of production changes.
And it's weird. I've heard the exact same thing at Pixar. I mean, you know, it's the whole notion of, you know, you can't just reuse the rigs when you're doing a new film with Buzz or Woody, because it's like, no, you know, the rigs have changed, you know. And but that said, you can understand why people might have sparked this rumor. I mean, think about what just happened in the past year with Nimona.
Yeah.
A film that supposedly died at Blue Sky found a new home over at Netflix. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I'd love if this could actually happen, because it sounds like a fun premise. But at the same time, it just, you know, sometimes the ship sails, you know, that just the way it is. Anyway, you also had another story that you wanted to share some info about, the Shout Factory acquisition of certain Henson titles, right?
Yes, they announced a big deal with Henson, and they announced that Labyrinth and The Dark Crystal were part of this deal, but also that things like The Storyteller were going to get re-released, which I'm just so excited about. And, you know, it made me think, Jim, about the original deal for the Henson properties from 1989.
You're gonna break my heart again.
Yeah.
I mean,
all of that was included.
Everything.
Right?
Everything.
Yeah.
If Jim Henson had gone to the hospital just a couple of days earlier, you know, what we might have gotten out of that guy, more to the point, the fact that all of this stuff would have been under the Disney umbrella. And, you know, release through home video and that sort of thing. Just the fact that the pieces of now are just sort of scattered to the four winds. By the way, was there any information there in regard to whether or not the Dark Crystal limited series, that was done for Netflix, right?
It was Netflix. Yeah, I think Netflix still controls that, but I think it's going to be good. I think we're going to get new versions of it on home video as well as digital. I just talked to the CEO of Shout on Friday bit about this. Okay. But and hopefully a new cleaned up version of Storyteller, which I don't think has ever really properly been released on any kind of high definition format.
I'd love to revisit that material, because if you remember how visually stunning that was, you know, when it first came through the door, weren't there like 8 Greek fables, that sort of thing?
I believe that is also part of this deal. Yeah. And the other thing that they should have the rights to is the, the non-storyteller half hours of the Jim Henson Hour. So like Dog Police or whatever. What was it? Dog.
Yeah.
And Song of the Cloud Forest and Monster Maker and those kind of things. I don't know if they're going to put them out, but I think that is part of this deal. Sometimes you'll see those pop up on streaming. What was the weird one about the lighthouse? The guy that goes to this like mysterious, I think Jerry Jewell wrote it. Do you remember this? And there's sort of mermaids and things. Lighthouse Island.
There we go. I mean, it's just the heartbreak with that one in particular. I mean, when Jim went to NBC and sold them on the idea of it's time to do another, you know, Walt Disney, you know, Wonderful World of Color, like anthology. He literally stepped into the Walt Disney role. He hosted the show. And I want to say 3 episodes in, it was dead. You know, it just, at that point, it's like, you didn't do the numbers, we're killing the show.
It was kind of an odd format. Because it wasn't as long as having the two halves was very odd, I thought. But I love the show and I love the Muppet stuff.
I think that's the one part of the Muppet puzzle that if you think about all the shows that followed the original Muppet show, you know, that was done in syndication. It was one of these things they didn't have to worry about some guy out in L.A. or some guy in New York looking at what the ratings were. They just had to please each individual market that was buying the show and deciding, you know, is it going to air on Tuesday nights at 7:30 or Friday nights at, you know, at 10 or whatever. You know, to be completely honest, if you look at the Muppet Show, the show is finding its way in season 1. It doesn't really hit its stride till season 2. And that was the thing. Everything that Henson did sort of had to find its way till you know, yeah, you had characters like Gonzo suddenly, you know, rise up out of, you know, out of the cast, or for that matter, Piggy, who was just sort of a glorified extra who, you know, became, you know, virtually the co-star of the show. But all right, anyway, that is great news that Shout Factory is going to make, you know, Labyrinth and Dark Crystal and all of these other weird little Henson projects available in home video. And speaking of home video, Disney's Wish, which was released to theaters back on November 22nd, I have been asking around in regard to when this Chris Buck and Fawn Vera Sun Thorne film is going to become available on home video. And what I'm hearing is the Blu-ray is going to become available either on Tuesday, February 20th or Tuesday, February 27th. And as we mentioned as the lead-in for this episode, once upon a time, these sorts of things, these releases on, well, back in the day, VHS and Beta, were a huge part of the revenue stream associated with the new animated feature. No longer. I don't want to say Disney Plus basically ruined that, but why would you want to own a physical copy of a film that you could stream? Now, mind you, and we have, Drew and I bring this up on the show all the time with Guillermo del Toro's comment last year that physical media is almost a Fahrenheit 451 level of responsibility these days, that you got to own the physical copies of this media. But once upon a time, the only way that you could see a Disney animated film was when it was re-released to theaters. Now, mind you, Disney stood outside of the home video phenomena for a while and eyeballed it. Because, again, the whole notion of the way Disney made money was the vault. You know, that you release the film and then you put it back in the vault for 7 years and you only brought it out when there was a brand new generation of children who could then get excited about this movie and beg and plead to their parents to buy the toys and the books and the LP and all that. And
these were typically over the holiday as well, right?
Yep. Well, now where this gets interesting is Disney decides in March of 1980. I mean, mind you, they'd launched their home video division in 78, but it was, you know, it was this weird hodgepodge of stuff that they put out. But they finally decided, okay, let's test to see if there's really appetite out there for, you know, Disney titles on home video. And so March 8th of 1980, they chose four specific cities to roll this stuff out into. It was Chicago, Houston, Philadelphia, and San Francisco. And there were only 13 titles initially that they made available. And those were the Apple Dumpling Gang, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, The Black Hole, Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier, then Escape to Witch Mountain, Hot Lead and Cold Feet, a favorite of Drew's, you can just tell. what is it? The Love Bug, The North End Irregulars, Peace Dragon, and 20,000 Leagues Under the Seas. And now, obviously, no animated features on that list, but there were a couple of compilations of animated shorts. There was a thing called On Vacation with Mickey Mouse and Friends, Kids Are Kids with Donald Duck, and then Adventures with Chip and Dale. Now, mind you, these things, Drew, were going for over $100 a copy. And why that was that this was in the heyday of the video store?
Yes, I remember it. I worked in a video store for 10 years, Jim. I saw it at its peak, and I saw it as it was starting to fall off. And I remember tapes would be like $79 just for the rental stores, because then you would be able to rent them out, you know, and conceivably earn that back. But then the sell-through concept was different and only applied. I remember, like, E.T. came out, like, mm-hmm, I don't know, 3 years after it was in theaters or something, right? Mm-hmm. And that was the sell-through. Yeah. You could find that at Target. But most of the time, it was, yeah, you could only rent.
Well, and that was the thing. The notion was that price, you know, was set with the notion of most copies will be purchased by video rental stores, but the customers that really, really, really want it and have deep pockets and in most cases, would go to a video store and buy that title. That's where they'd go. So anyway, test was deemed successful. Walt Disney Home Entertainment now makes goes nationwide, and to get people excited about this new offering, on December 30th, 1980, they make Mary Poppins, the biggest live-action hit in the vault, available again with the notion of mostly for the rental market. Now, which were the first feature-length animated films made available through Disney Home Video? First one was Dumbo, got released again toward the rental market in June of 1981. And then just a few months later, Alice in Wonderland came out in October of 81. But again, you know, with this artificial $100, you know, plus price point. And where this gets interesting is that we jump ahead a couple of years. And what's really ironic about this story is it was Eisner, right, at Paramount, with Paramount Home Entertainment, that they began to play with price points for titles. I want to say, didn't they have like Star Trek The Wrath of Khan that they cut the price in half for to see what would happen, you know, whether or not Star Trek fans would go for that? And now, mind you, this is prior to Eisner arriving at Disney, right?
Yeah. I mean, Paramount did some interesting things on home video too, especially. I think that the Star Trek thing kind of opened the gates. Do you remember, this was after Eisner had left, but they would sell them in McDonald's. They would sell the tapes for like $3.99 or something in McDonald's. I mean, they were really creative in terms of how to get some of these things out. But yeah, as far as I know, Eisner's experience with Star Trek led him to say when he got to Disney, we got to put these out for everybody, right?
That's it, exactly. Okay, so... So Robin Hood from 1973 becomes the first new-ish Disney title, animated title, and they do a full national ad campaign. But again, it's still got its $79 price. Now, mind you, that's the thing. Disney thought, ooh, we're making a big concession here. We're going to go from over $100 to just $79.95 for an animated feature. And, you know, but again, Eisner comes through the door with Frank Wells in late September, early October of 84. And Eisner wants to know right off the bat, you know, how, you know, Robin Hood did. You know, he wants those numbers on his desk. And, you know, and Eisner looks at it and it's like, well, you know, Robin Hood, you know, is one of our lesser titles, you know, but what might happen if we put one of our, you know, our biggest films, you know, one of the most famous Disney titles out there, made that available for you know, home purchase. And so July of 1985, Pinocchio is released on home video, but it's still that $79.95 price point. And again, largely because most titles are still being sold to video rental stores. And Eisner is disappointed that a famous, beloved Disney title like that, it only manages to sell 100,000 copies in North America. But at the same time, Eisner gets a report on his desk that says that in the United States at that time, and you're going to love this, Drew, there were 25 million VCRs in the country at that point. And that was significantly up from the number of VCRs that had been owned in American homes in 83 and 84. And so Eisner's looking at this and again, keeps in mind what had happened with Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan. And it's one of these things where it's like, yeah, no, I bet if we cut the price on Pinocchio, we'll move a lot more copies. So November 6, 1985, and this is what, 4 months, 5 months after it had first gone on sale, Disney announces that the price of Pinocchio has just dropped to $29.95. And before Christmas morning of that year, an additional 300,000 copies of Pinocchio had been sold. And at that point, Eisner never looked back. You know, it just sort of like, okay, that's the price point. In fact, when Sleeping Beauty came out in October of the following year, 1986, it started at $29.95. And I think that was the first one they moved over a million copies of. And that was for the home market, not the video. In fact, I have to ask, Drew, you were there when a lot of this went on. How did the video stores react when suddenly the Disney titles were so obviously aimed at the home market rather than the rental market?
Well, I didn't work at a video store until like the early 2000s. So by that time, that cadence had been established. But I do remember, you know, this was also the time when Beta and VHS were battling it out. And I wonder if Disney's commitment to VHS is what totally killed the Betamax movement. I don't know if you ever had a Betamax. It was better quality.
We did. My dad actually did the research, and it was like, it's better quality. You can, you know, tape more on, you know, for longer on the tapes. And we had a Beta there at the house for years. In fact, I have some stuff that I taped on the Beta that to this day, it kind of kills me because it's broken and I don't know where to take our Beta machine to get it repaired. But there's stuff that I've got taped, whether it's Disney specials or news programs or that sort of thing that I'd love to have for research that I just can't get access to because I don't have something that can play it. In fact, I remember moaning to Becky Klein at the Disney archive about this very same issue. She was in the same position. She has all of this Disney stuff that's on Beta and, you know, what do we watch it on? You know, and
certainly somebody's got to be out there. Maybe somebody listening to this very program, Jim, can help you out.
Here's hoping. Okay. Well, all right. Anyway, now speaking of VHSs and DVDs and Blu-rays, the 4K Blu-ray version of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 was released back on October 31st of last year. Of course, you would know that if you were listening to Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, which Drew does with his equally talented co-host, Charles Hood. And what are you and Charles up to on Light the Fuse these days?
I think we're doing some revisiting episodes right now. So classic episodes from the Light the Fuse catalog, which have been redone. And will be available for all of you. I think we're doing like Brad Bird and Brian De Palma and a whole bunch of the heavy hitters. So if you, for some reason, missed out on these episodes, you have another shot at them every Tuesday.
Cool. Okay. Well, and speaking of podcasts, we have a few here on Jim Hill Media we'd like you to check out. We, of course, have Disney Dish, which I do with Len Testa. We also have Looking at Lucasfilm with Brian Gaughan. He and I will be doing a brand new episode of that later this week. Let's see what else. Eric Hersey and I just recorded, partially recorded. We're getting some other elements pulled together, but our brand new Universal podcast, the Epic Universal podcast, look for that to debut sometime in the next week to 10 days. And let's see. And I'm working on getting Marvelous Disney back up, folks. Give me a little more time here. Let's see. Oh, speaking of Marvelous Disney, and again, want to thank everybody who contributed to the GoFundMe for our late editor, Aaron Adams. Last time we looked, Nancy was telling me it's up over 14,000, damn near 15,000 at this point, and all of those funds go to Aaron's widow, Sabrina Geiger. So thank you so much for your contributions, folks. The latest episode of Disney Unpacked, the video project that Len and I are doing with veteran Imagineer Jim Shull, just went live. And this episode is about Mickey's Birthday Land, the development and construction of that new land at the Magic Kingdom in Walt Disney World. Some great stories there. Beyond that, Drew, social media-wise, where are we these days?
Same places, you know, Twitter, Instagram, the inside of a darkened cave wall. Yeah, all of those places, yeah.
Drew does some wonderful, you know, drawings of antelopes and mastodons while he's at that. You know,
yes.
And social media-wise, same thing here. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram as Jim Hill Media, and over on Facebook is Jim Hill Media News. Mr. Taylor, on the other hand, if you're looking for him, it's Drew Tailored Like a Tailored Suit, right?
Yes, that's it, Jim. You know it.
Okay, cool. Final favor here, folks. If you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review, well, not just the podcast you're listening to right now, Fine Tuning, but also Light the Fuse. That would be extremely helpful. And I guess that's going to do it for this week. So this time next week, Drew and I will take a look at what happened to the Golden Globes, and we'll see where we're headed animated award season-wise. But till then, thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.